You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Coming up later in the program, we'll get a special preview of the new Wisconsin Life TV show launching tonight at 8 on Wisconsin Public Television.
But first, from far-out space sounds to mimicking acoustic instruments, synthesizers give musicians an ability to produce almost limitless kinds of sounds.
Since their introduction in the early 20th century, these innovative instruments have been at the forefront of music technology. And our next guest has had the opportunity to play with nearly every kind of synthesizer created.
Joining us now is music educator, performer, and journalist Mark Vail. He's the author of the new book, The Synthesizer, a comprehensive guide to understanding, programming, playing, and recording the ultimate electronic musical instrument. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob. It's pleasure to be here.
When I think of a synthesizer, I think of something with a piano-like keyboard. But I, from reading your book, know it's more than just that. Can you give us a basic definition of what a synthesizer is?
It's an electronic instrument that is capable of making many different kinds of sounds and also processing sounds from other sources, whether they be acoustic or electronic or otherwise. And they became probably best known for having a keyboard because of certain popular models, but over the years there have been many different ways to learn to be able to play the instrument, developments in for those.
And looking through the pictures in your book, it could be anything from a keyboard, as I imagined, or a computer program, or the older ones, just a big, it looks like it could be a, you know, an airplane control room, the cockpit, just a bunch of dials and switches.
Yes, and some of them look like what old telephone operators used to plug callers together with.
Well, tell me about the first time you heard a synthesizer and why it got your attention and you made it such a big part of your career.
Actually, it may have been something I read first. When I was finishing up high school in 1973, there was a publication called The Last Whole Earth Catalog. And Wendy Carlos wrote an article in there about synthesizers, and it just really piqued my interest. And then I discovered bands like Emerson, Lake & Palmer and Yes, who depended a lot on synthesized sounds. And it went from there. So I've been interested in the subject since the early 70s.
Well, let's. You just mentioned Wendy Carlos. A lot of people might think pop and rock music, but she really pioneered the use of with a classical album, Switched on Bach. Let's give a listen. So that's Wendy Carlos playing on a Moog. Looks like Moog, pronounced Moog synthesizer. First, can you talk about Wendy Carlos's role in pioneering the use of this instrument?
Well, the technology that she was working with, she helped Bob Moog work on some of those devices. And they were analog circuitry that tended to drift depending on room temperature and static electricity and humidity. And to record that album and others, she had to be very conscious of the tone and also the pitch that came out of those instruments. So it was a lot of meticulous work that she recorded onto audio tape, magnetic audio tape. And many years later, she was able to resurrect those tapes and digitize them for CDs.
And I mentioned the Moog synthesizer, and you mentioned Bob Moog. He was a huge pioneer in on the technological side, wasn't he?
Yes, he started in 1963 and 64 in the New York area. Almost at the same time, Don Buchla began developing electronic instruments at the San Francisco Tape Music Center.
Let's turn to the Beatles now. Now, a lot of bands will have a pure sounding, something you'd say, oh, that must be a synthesizer. Others have layered them in with organic instruments, and our producer, Carl, found a kind of a back-to-back contrast here. I want to listen to a little bit of the Beatles song, Here Comes the Sun, a brief snippet here. All right, that's the original. Now, what somebody has done on YouTube is isolate some of the tracks from the Beatles song and done their own mix. So let's listen to that same bit and hear what comes out. Some strings there, real strings. What? And that's amazing, I think, in a lot of ways. It's hidden in there. It adds a texture mark, but it doesn't leap right out at you. Can you talk about the different ways people have integrated that synthesizer sound in with what we think of as traditional or organic instruments?
Well, that was a Moog modular synthesizer that the Beatles had, and Abbey Road Studios actually gave them their own separate room to keep that in. The sounds that Wendy Carlos and others used those analog synthesizers to create, they kind of approached the acoustic sounds, but that wasn't their entire purpose. Later developments allowed people to record strings into a sampler and then play them back and filter them like with a synthesizer. So there has been the gamut of trying to recreate acoustic sounds with electronic instruments and also to create unique sounds that might be soothing or very, very irritating. So there's a whole gamut that they've been used. And you hear a lot of synthesizers in music on the radio, on the internet, on television and movie soundtracks that you have no idea that that's actually created using synthesizers.
That was a big challenge, wasn't it? Wendy Carlos, I think you wrote, was frustrated early on because you could get a saxophone-like sound or a violin-like sound, but the idiosyncrasies of the instrument, the sound of the bow on the string or the unique reed growly sounds on a saxophone were really hard to capture, the attack and the sustain and things like that.
Yes, and I think more synthesis, I mean, they love to have control of the sound, but I think in electronic ways is more desirable than trying to reproduce or recreate acoustic sounds, because most synthesis would never want to replace acoustic musicians, and in fact, many of us enjoy playing with acoustic instruments.
There's been a complaint I've heard from musicians I've worked with over the years and from music fans. There's, I guess, since the beginning of the synthesizer and pop music in particular, the sound that it's cold, it's unemotional, it's scientific, it doesn't have the heart of a guitar or a wind instrument. You are a synthesizer guy. How do you answer that?
I would say that they're limiting what they're listening to. They may have heard it here or there, but I bet I could find some things that they might change their mind.
Are there any musicians that you think have really used the synthesizer to a great end and really brought out a lot of heart with the synthesizer?
I have to go back to Keith Emerson with Emerson, Lake & Palmer. He had a big, huge Moog modular synthesizer, similar to what the Beatles had. But he was willing to take the thing out on the stage. He would fire off sounds with a ribbon controller that actually could shoot fireworks out of it. he just put on this show that many keyboardists and synthesists on stage are kind of forced to be in one place where guitar players can run all over the stage. And Keith Emerson was really the first guy who broke that mold and showed that you could actually do a whole lot of things and still make exciting music.
I went through a monstrous Emerson, Lake & Palmer phase as a kid. Here's one of their huge hits, and we're going to come into a big synth solo here. It's Lucky Man. Okay, my colleagues in the studio are making fun of me for nodding along and air synthesizering here. Tell us about Lucky Man and that solo.
Interesting story. When I was at Keyboard Magazine, in the late 80s or early 90s, when Emerson, Lake & Palmer were going to go back on tour, Keith Emerson contacted us because he was aware that Jim Aiken, an editor at Keyboard, had transcribed that solo. And Keith forgot how to play it, so he needed to be reminded. So I actually faxed the printout from the magazine to Keith so that he knew how to play that solo.
Wow. So it was a lost, well, not a lost chord, but a lost solo that Keyboard Magazine helped him recreate.
Yeah, we helped him remember how he did it.
Did he remember the patch to use, the keyboard programmed patch?
Oh, I doubt it, because with the modular synthesizer, if you change anything, it can change the sound drastically. So I'm sure he came close, but it may not have been perfect.
We're talking with Mark Vail about his new book on synthesizers, how they came to be such a huge part of our modern musical landscape.
You can join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Are you a musician? What are some of your favorite synthesizer songs? Or maybe you think these instruments have ruined the way we experience music. You can tell us why you think so. Again, that number is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. From the experimentation of the Beatles to Cher's auto-tuned voice, synthesizers are everywhere in popular music, whether we are aware of it or not.
We're talking with author and synthesizer expert Mark Vail about the impact these instruments have had on modern music. You can join the discussion. Do you have a favorite musician, artist, band that uses synthesizers? Or least favorite? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org. We'll go right to the phones. We've got John with us in Neenah. John, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to react to your comment that some people sometimes make fun of synthesizers or have an aversion to it. And I'm of the opinion, and a lot of my musician friends, we think that synthesizers kind of got a bad name when sequencers came along, and a lot of bands or artists were coming out with synthesizers or computers just playing itself or playing the track, or you have tracks flown in on the stage and nobody knows where it's coming from. And I think people maybe appreciate more seeing people actually play the instrument, seeing a real live person up there playing the electronic instrument, but still actually playing and performing rather than having the computer play itself.
John, thanks a lot for the call. That's an interesting distinction, Mark. It's not so much the hatred of the synthesizer, but the sequenced drum, bass, and rhythm track behind somebody singing on stage.
And that's very true. It can be used like backing tracks, like some people accused of mouthing to a recording track. The sequencer I think John is referring to is like what you do on a computer. You play, the musician plays parts into the computer, and then the computer plays the synthesizers back. Sequencers actually go back to almost during the early 60s, both Bob Moog and Don Buchla developed what were called step sequencers that would play the same ostinato over and over again. And they came back, modular synthesizers almost disappeared during the 80s because of digital synthesizers. But modular synthesizers began coming back in the 90s, and a lot of people are using those kind of analog step sequencers again, but they're very different than the songwriting tools that I think John is talking about that have been overused in live performances. So yeah, it is a fine line. People certainly would rather see real people playing things on the stage and not looking like they're checking their email on their computer.
Well, that reminds me of a band that really does it both ways, Nine Inch Nails, where Trent Reznor does a lot of, as I understand it, a lot of the albums by himself with sequencing, but then tours with the live band with, in addition to the synthesizers, real drums, bass, guitar.
I really appreciate that way of working. Like I said before, I appreciate working with acoustic musicians and electroacoustic musicians and mixing electronics and acoustics together. And I do get a little offended when people say, well, synthesizers aren't natural instruments. I have never seen a violin tree. The only natural instrument, you know, could be drums made from a tree or your voice. So they're all man-made.
Thanks a lot for the call, John. We'll go now to Joe in Madison. Joe, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I had a question for your guest on synthesizer build-it-your-own kits. I'm thinking about building one maybe out of an Arduino that I have, and was curious if he has ever, your guest has ever built his own, and if so, if there was a particular design that he was partial to.
All right, Joe wants to make something with his Arduino do-it-yourself electronics kit. Is there a good, easy way to start?
Boy, that sounds like fun. I have put kits together. I have never designed one on my own. I have an Arduino, and it's something that one day I hope to work with. But there are a lot of people making their own synthesizers, DIY, either from existing kits or also from designing their own from scratch. I do have information in that in my book about that, because there's a wide community that that type of activity is going on internationally. It's kind of hard to give you a link over the radio, but they're in there. They're out there. If you do a search online, you can find all kinds of information about do-it-yourself synthesis.
All right. Good luck, Joe, and maybe you can call us up and play us a tune when you get that together. We'll go to Drew in Brooklyn now. Drew, hi.
Yes, hello. A wonderful, interesting show. I remember in the 70s, Stevie Wonder's albums were thought to be produced largely by a synthesizer, and what your guests might have to say about that.
Thanks for the call, Drew. And wow, talk about a soulful musician embracing this instrument. Doesn't get much more soulful than Stevie Wonder.
Well, definitely. Stevie used for several of his albums something called Tonto, which was one of the largest modular synthesizers ever produced. So, yes, indeed, he did use synthesizers, analog synthesizers. Later on, he met up with Ray Kurzweil, a futuristic visionary, and the two of them did a lot of work together to make electronic sounds both more interesting to hear and to develop new ways of controlling them musically. So, yes, Stevie Wonder has long been a user of synthesizers, and he's one of my favorite musicians, too.
I remember a Grammy thing with him, Herbie Hancock, Thomas Dolby, and Howard Jones demonstrating a castle of technology. My head almost exploded in nerdly joy. We'll go back to the phones now. We've got Donna with us in Fond du Lac. Hi, Donna.
Hi. I was calling just to talk about one of my favorite experiences with synthesizers as a teenager, and that was listening to Peter Frampton.
Oh, and the Frampton Comes Live, and he's got that, is that mouth thing that he used, a synthesizer, Mark? The, do you feel like we do, sound that he had on that? Sorry.
Actually, no, it isn't a synthesizer.
Right?
It's called a talk box, which has a little amplified speaker in it that's enclosed, and then there's a tube that comes out from where that speaker is, and Peter and other people who have used these type of instruments insert that tube in their mouth where they can change the cavity shape to filter the sound and say things like, do you feel like I do? So, no, that actually isn't a synthesizer, but it's a very fun technique.
I want to play another clip of a synthesizer making the jump into rock pop, really grabbing the attention. It's Van Halen here. That's Van Halen Jump, which was, I don't know, number one for 90 weeks or something when I was a kid. Was that a big crossover? They were a rock, kind of a hardish rock pop band embracing the synthesizer, Mark.
Yeah, they did take some flack for that. That wonderful sound that Van Halen made was with an Oberheim OBXA synthesizer, a polyphonic instrument. Tom Oberheim, who designed that, was also one of the pioneers who brought us to where we are today. And this kind of goes back to the sequencer thing. Tom designed a sequencer to play with his monophonic synthesizer, and by monophonic I mean it only plays one note at a time. So after he'd completed his sequencer, he realized he didn't have an instrument to play at the same time. So he developed another little synthesizer called the SEM, Synth Expander Module. And then he used that to create some of the earliest polyphonic synthesizers, instruments that could play more than one note at a time. And that eventually led to a complete instrument like the OBXA that was used in Jump.
Well, we've just really scratched the surface here of the history of the synthesizer and the bands that have used it. I want to look toward the future, though. We've seen auto-tune all over. People are doing auto-tuning speeches at home. Studios are using more and more different kinds of synthesized sounds. Processor speed is sped up. Where is this going? What does the future of music with synthesizers look like to you, Mark?
Well, I would say personal computers have for a couple of decades now been fast enough to actually do synthesis. And we've seen just a ton of development in laptop computers, also iOS devices like the iPhone and the iPad. And so there has been a lot of sophisticated development for those items. And at the same time, analog synthesis has become popular again. So I've talked to experts in the field who think that perhaps, well, when manufacturers create a new digital synthesizer, it takes them months and possibly even a year or longer to actually get it developed. And by the time it's ready to make, the microprocessors that are inside the unit have been replaced by faster ones. So the benefit of doing it with your computer is you can upgrade your computer as necessary, and then the software manufacturers keep those working.
Uh-huh.
So digital synthesis may go into the computer, and hardware instruments may, that's where analog synthesis, sounds that are generated with analog techniques, may stay strong in that realm.
We'll leave it there. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It was my pleasure, Rob.
That was Mark Vail. His new book is The Synthesizer, A Comprehensive Guide to Understanding, Programming, Playing, and Recording the Ultimate Electronic Musical Instrument.